You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Most schools in the Milwaukee area are kicking off their fall semester this week. This includes Milwaukee Public Schools, which has been in the headlines lately for its shrinking teacher numbers. And the year begins with a new state budget, which allocates no new spending on public schools in the first year and a small boost in funding in the second year.
The school year for Milwaukee, the state's largest public school district, began with a rally for teachers who are working with administrators to help close the achievement gap in the city. In the past year, a report from the Annie E. Casey Foundation placed Wisconsin worst among the 50 states for racial disparities in education outcomes. And the Civil Rights Project from the University of California, Los Angeles, found Wisconsin high schools suspend black children at a higher rate than any other state.
Dakota Irby joins us now. He's assistant professor in the Department of Educational Policy Studies at the University of Illinois at Chicago. Last year, he spoke with a group of Wisconsin superintendents about his experiences as an African-American kid going through various school systems, public and private. He joins us now to talk about the achievement gap in Wisconsin's public schools and what might work to improve it. Dakota, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, you're a professor at the University of Illinois now, but you still do most of your work in Wisconsin. With the challenges out there for Milwaukee public schools, what do you think the top priority should be to get kids off to the best start possible?
Well, I think, you know, some of them you mentioned in the introduction to the segment. I mean, funding is a huge issue. You know, we're in, at a time, you know, in a state, in a city where we just allocated quite a bit of money to a public, privately held arena and sports team. At the expense of public schools that are in dire need of teachers in a district where a disproportionate number of students are identified as special needs, or roughly 20%. So a lot of it has to do with resources. And then the other piece has quite a bit to do with things that teachers can be doing. I tend to try to focus a lot on what's within the locus of control of educators. And so I guess how I would answer that question would depend on who that audience is. So the response to policymakers or the teachers or the parents would be very different based on what their sphere of influence actually is.
Now, I know you talk about this from the policy angle. That's your field of expertise. But this is also something that you've been talking about from a first-person experience, you yourself being an African-American kid in schools, public and private schools. And last year, you spoke to a group of state superintendents. What did you want them to know about what your school experience was like for you?
Well, the reason that I actually started to talk about my personal experience more is that, as you indicated, I talk a lot about policy and understand numbers and statistics and those sorts of things. And I went through a leadership training program that really helped me to realize that to make all of that matter requires that people understand experiences and people's stories and those sorts of things. So I spent my time with those superintendents from the greater Milwaukee region. Really just talking about my relationships with teachers, my relationships with adults in my life who really, you know, pushed me to excel even in ways that I didn't imagine for myself. And so one of the, you know, what I like to call it is an emphasis or focus on relational resources. So we could talk about financial resources, there's curricular resources and those sorts of things, but relationships are also fundamental to how young people experience schools. And it was fundamental to how I experienced school, both positive as well as kind of negative relationships that I experienced going through school.
So what kind of relationships made a positive difference in your life?
Well, Lisa Delpit, scholar Lisa Delpit, and several other scholars call people who are kind of firm, have very high expectations in terms of academics, but also are nurturers. They call them warm demanders. And I think that those people who are warm demanders played the most influential role in, you know, my schooling experiences. So when I talk to folks, I talk about my middle school principal, Mr. Cotton. I talk about my history teacher, Ms. Willoughby, my guidance counselor, Ms. Gregory. And so I talk about these folks, and I really try to get down to the minute detail of what were the things that they actually did. What were the things that they actually would say to me that made a difference. I also talk about my mom. She was a warm demander. So these are people who are able to strike a good balance between very high expectations, academic rigor, but also being willing to provide, number one, the support in terms of being able to perform academically and help students learn so they're masters at what their craft, at what they do. But they also have this very kind of difficult to really describe, but there's something about their cultural competence and their ability to relate to young people and to students in a way that helps young people feel valued in the sense of dignity in the education process. And so I spend time talking with them about that because those are the things that are squarely within the sphere of influence of the educators and the leaders who encounter students on a daily basis.
Now you're talking about these warm demanders, and you're also, as you said, a statistics guy, a policy guy. Are there statistics and data to back up that idea that these warm demanders who can nurture and approach from that angle and yet still demand things, that works?
Right. Well, there is and there is not, right? Because a lot of what we see in terms of the statistics and the data that we have that's accessible depends on what people feel is important and what data is collected. So we don't have a lot of data, but we do have a lot of anecdotal information, a lot of books. One that comes to mind that's specific to this state is Gloria Lassen-Billings. Her book, Dream Keepers, focuses on people who have done an exceptional job continuously and on an ongoing basis working with low-income African-American children. And I think that she would probably qualify them as warm demanders as well. And so what she basically found and what has been found over and over in terms of people who have replicated these sorts of studies, that these folks had very high expectations in terms of academics. They were good teachers, first and foremost, but they also were highly culturally competent, understanding their students' cultural context and what their students needed. And then this aspect of critical consciousness, teaching students to be change agents, to be deep thinkers, and to be critical and to be thinking about how to actually change their world. So there's a lot of books, anecdotal evidence that demonstrates that these warm demanders are very effective teachers. But, you know, when teachers are evaluated, they don't check a box that says I'm a warm demander, or they're not characterized as a warm demander. So we're not able to actually see these kind of differences emerge within the data that we typically use for policy decision making.
As the school year begins, we're talking with Dakota Irby about how Wisconsin's public schools could close the achievement gap. Dakota is an assistant professor in the Department of Educational Policy Studies at the University of Illinois at Chicago, does a lot of research still in Wisconsin. And what do you think, Dakota, that teachers and administrators, especially those who aren't from a minority community, what might they not know about what the experience is like from a kid's perspective?
Well, there's a lot that they don't know. But I found that there's a lot of things that also resonate. So some people may not know what it is to be in my skin, for example. I'm a black male. I identify as black. So they may not know what, it means to be in my skin. But many people have experienced feeling humiliated, for example, feeling marginalized. Many people have experiences, a lot of teachers have experiences being poor. It's especially here in the state of Wisconsin, when I work with schools, a lot of times when we talk about experiences of marginalization, a lot of people have poverty and being poor is something that comes to the forefront for them. So there are some ways that teachers and school leaders can and do identify with students who are, underperforming. But then there are some other ways, like I mentioned, race and those sorts of things, English language learners, students who have who are immigrants, undocumented students. A lot of people don't have the kind of experiences that lend them a particular kind of like sensitivity to those kinds of issues. And that's really where a lot of emphasis on cultural competence and those sorts of things become very important. And I know that our state superintendent of education has made cultural competence and especially emphasis on racial equity a focus within the state of Wisconsin. And the reason that that's probably a focus is because those are the kinds of things that require a lot more attention and conversation if we're to effectively address them.
Now, speaking about developing those sensitivities, one thing that we might have thought worked at one point is centering the curriculum around race-neutral and class-neutral concepts. But you say that that doesn't work. Why not?
It doesn't work because it goes back to this idea of kind of critical consciousness. A huge part of being able to compel young people to perform and get young people to perform is that teachers need to actually be learners too, and be aware of those kinds of racial differences or things that they might not be aware of. There's a whole you know, I could run down a list of different kinds of so-called race-neutral policies that actually end up having, you know, huge racial implications. Vouchers, charter school movement is one of those. So there's this idea, for example, that, charter schools are going to deal with the issue of race and racial inequities in education. And what we actually see is that the charter schools don't perform any better, and in some areas perform worse than the traditional public schools. And so a lot of it is that there's a lot of kind of policies, but the, you know, if we go back to Du Bois, if we go back to King, if we go back to a lot of folks, one of the primary issues in this country that we are all too happy to ignore is the issues along lines of race and racism. And they're endemic to American culture, and we're just happy to skip over them, but unless policies are specifically focused on issues of race or gender or immigration status and those sorts of things, they actually in the long term have very little effect on being able to change people's hearts and to change policies as well.
As the school year begins here in Wisconsin, we're talking with Dakota Irby about how Wisconsin's public schools could begin to close the achievement gap. Dakota's assistant professor in the Department of Educational Policy Studies at the University of Illinois at Chicago.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What do you think needs to be done to close this achievement gap in the state, and what do things look like? What's going on in your school? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue that conversation after a look at the latest news with Kristen Durst.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. As the school year gets going, we're talking now with Dakota Irby about how Wisconsin's public schools could begin to close the achievement gap. Dakota's assistant professor in the Department of Educational Policy Studies at the University of Illinois at Chicago.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. How do you think Wisconsin can close the achievement gap? What do you think kids need from teachers to succeed if they come from minority groups or disadvantaged backgrounds? If you're a kid from a minority group, what do you want your school to know about you and how you need to learn? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll go to our callers now. We have Monica with us in Milwaukee. Hi, Monica.
Hello.
What do you think?
Well, I am a retired teacher in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. I have been teaching in Milwaukee for 40 years, and one of the things I've noticed that now that I'm working part-time as a substitute is the increase in class size, and I can't, it's just gotten abysmal. I've been in seventh grade classrooms with 55 students, and I know that children build, achieve discipline and self-discipline in part by their relationship with their teacher, and you can't build a relationship when you've got 55 students per class for five class periods a day. You really can't do that, and kids don't relate to somebody they don't know, and they don't use them as an example. And I'd just like your guest to address that. I'm driving in the car, and I need to hang up, but I'd like
understand.
To hear his response.
Sure. Thank you so much, Monica, for that. 55 in a class. I hadn't heard numbers quite like that before. Monica's saying that's some of her experience. But what about those class sizes, Dakota? Is that something we should be taking into account?
Yeah, absolutely, and that goes back to, you know, my initial response to the question of what can be done, and talking about different kinds of resources. And so the resources to actually provide enough teachers to have a reasonable teacher-student ratio is critically important, because without that particular resource, enough teachers. Exactly as your caller mentioned, it undermines the potential for the students to build a kind of relationships. And it also makes teaching more difficult for the teachers as well. So I agree with her. The research bears that out. In my research, I found those similar things. So I would just agree with what she has to say.
So that's a funding issue, right?
Yes.
So you have more money, you can hire more teachers and reduce class sizes.
Well, you know, yeah, if you have, and a lot of it boils down to, you know, political will and decision making and those sorts of things. Budgets are values documents. And just because there's more money doesn't mean that more money gets allocated to things that go directly to classroom instruction and to teachers. So, you know, it's, it's more money, but it's also how is money allocated within the school system. An example is, you know, I'm thinking about, you know, the personnel that are in schools. Milwaukee, for example, I think in 2009 was identified as their middle school students were suspended at the highest rate in the nation. And that's changed over time. And so, you know, the questions that come to mind are like, you know, if are you spending resources on security and school resource officers and that sort of personnel, or do you allocate resources to people who are in the building in an instructional capacity? So a lot of it is about more resources, but also how those resources are allocated.
Well, thank you, Monica. We're going to go next to Paul. Paul joins us from Sturgeon Bay. Hi, Paul.
Hey, guys. How are you?
Good, thanks.
Good.
My comment was that I have a unique perspective in that I'm in Door County now, but I've been teaching for close to 20 years, and I taught in Chicago. And I, this year, make less than 50% of what I did 10 years ago in Chicago, but I'm able to stay in the profession because I don't have a lot of debt. And I think that Wisconsin's gotten to the point now where, for teachers, a lot of it has become about the money, which was never... It was a calling more than anything, because there was an implied living wage, and the reality is now that that's changed.
Paul, thank you for that. And what about teacher salaries, Dakota? Is that something that needs to be factored in?
Yeah, absolutely. Teachers are important. I think that they should be compensated accordingly. It is important. I'm not an expert on that particular area, but it is an important indicator of teacher quality, as well as teacher retention and those sorts of things, which, again, is critically important in terms of what students' experiences are in the classroom, in terms of the quality of learning that's taking place.
And we know that there is right now a big cultural conversation going on about standardized testing in schools. Could you tell us a little bit about how that plays maybe into the achievement gap and how standardized testing, maybe high-stakes standardized testing, should be handled and maybe framed when it comes to achievement?
Yeah, well, you know, one of the things is I like to spend a lot of time on this area because testing has never worked in the favor of oppressed or marginalized groups in society. And if we think specifically about the kind of tests that we use that are related to, like, intelligence and those sorts of things, the roots, the intellectual underpinnings of them were established early in the 21st century, by scientists who were part of this, what is called the eugenics movement. And the eugenics movement was really a group of scientists, which has largely been discredited now, but it was a group of scientists who basically wanted to link genetics to intellectual kind of ability. As you might imagine, when this emerged in the early, you know, 1907 to 1939 was a huge era for genetic scientists. This was used to justify the mistreatment and the state-sponsored discrimination against people of color, especially African-American people. And so when you hear people talk about the tests are culturally biased and the tests are racist and those sorts of things, a lot of those kind of critiques people make those critiques in the spirit of understanding things like the eugenics movement and where we get things like the IQ test and where we get standardized testing from. They've always been designed to sort and to disadvantage people of color, especially black folks, poor folks. And they really contribute this kind of intellectual underpinnings. And it seems that in today's time, it seems like it's ridiculous to have a science that's specifically focused on documenting differences in ability and intelligence based on tests. But that's exactly what happened then, and the intellectual underpinnings remain today. And so, you know, it's a very narrow, the tests are a pretty narrow measure of a person's potential. It's their, it measures their potential for specific types of intelligence. And so I think keeping that in mind is important in light of us creating the kind of school systems that place that associate high stakes with standardized testing. So this is something I could talk about forever. This is a passion area for me. But, the standardized testing, high stakes standardized testing is indeed problematic. me personally, I never have been a good test taker. You know, I had to take my SAT and ACT several times. Mm-hmm. I graduated with a 2.7 grade point average. And when I went to graduate school, I scored an 18 and a 24 in the 18th and 24th percentile on my graduate record examination. And here today, you know, I'm a, you know, assistant
professor at the University of Illinois Chicago. I wish we could keep going. So much to talk about. Dakota, thank you so much for joining us.
Yep, thank you. I appreciate it.
We've been speaking with Dakota Irby, assistant professor in the Department of Educational Policy Studies at the University of Illinois at Chicago.